from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump's appointments of Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh have furthered the Supreme Court's rightward shift. But how did today's conservative majority come to be? A new Frontline documentary tackles that question, going back from the 1980s through to the failed nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016.
I thought, you know, how could members of the Senate with their bare faces hanging out stop this very appealing nominee about whom really not a bad word could be said?
A look at the battle for the high court and what today's right-leaning majority means for the country and issues like abortion. It's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. With multiple states recently passing strict anti-abortion laws, all eyes are on the Supreme Court. As its stance on the issue could soon be put to the test. In this hour of Forum, we're going to look at how the High Court's conservative majority could reshape a range of contentious constitutional issues. But first, we want to focus on how that conservative majority came to be, which is the subject of a new Frontline documentary called Supreme Revenge, airing on PBS this evening. Filmmaker Michael Kirk joins us to talk about how a 30-year grievance stemming from the failed nomination of Robert Bork back in 1987 led to the court's rightward shift and transformed judicial confirmations into partisan battles. Welcome, Michael Kirk. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Let me first tell you congratulations on a film which I think gives a real good overview of this historical process and the whole trajectory. And I think that it will be particularly of interest and most informative to younger listeners and younger viewers. And in fact, I want to go right to the historical here, because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell at the time of the Bork hearings was a first-term senator. He was outraged by Bork being denied a seat on the court. Let's hear a clip from your film that actually starts with McConnell speaking on the Senate floor.
To Robert Bork, you happen to be the one who set the new Senate standard that will be applied, in my judgment, by a majority of the Senate prospectively. Unfortunately, it got set over your dead body, so to speak, politically.
McConnell threatened that he and his Republican colleagues would use the same tactics when it mattered.
We're going to do it when we want to. And when we want to is going to be when the president, whoever he may be, sends up somebody we don't like.
Well, Michael Kirk, he was good to his word, and he did seek redemption and did seek a right-wing court and a court that would fall into that right-wing ideology, and it all began there with the Bork hearings.
When we found that piece of stock footage, I knew we had a movie, Michael. It was just amazing to me. I'd been, of course, paying attention during the Bork hearings and during Clarence Thomas and obviously the Kavanaugh hearings. But to be able to attach it all to one narrative character who grows from, you know, first-term senator who's outraged at something and shaking his fist at Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden and others, to the man who would become, who Mitch McConnell has become, the leader of the Senate, and somebody who did to Merrick Garland and Barack Obama exactly what he promised to do 30 years before, was, to me, an amazing through character and a through moment that helped pull it all together.
Well, you mentioned Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden, and certainly they were the enemies of Mitch McConnell in terms of who should be or shouldn't be on the court, and particularly during the Bork hearings. In fact, this was really an attempt to keep someone off the court who, well, was going to go against affirmative action and go against such things as women's choice.
It was the a lot of people we talked to said that this was the starting pistol of really politicizing the judicial nomination process in a way that hadn't ever quite been done before. In this way, out in public on national television, the Democrats, Ted Kennedy, who'd been warned and was worried that Reagan's final appointment to the court might be Robert Bork, was ready to go. Within an hour of the announcement by Reagan, Kennedy goes to the floor and does this incredibly incendiary statement, makes a statement that about Robert Bork's America with back alley abortions, civil rights being rolled back. It was an unbelievably intense a warning shot to the Republicans that business was different now. They had Norman Lear money involved in it from the People of the American Way and others. There were commercials. There was radio ads read by, and television ads read by Gregory Peck. It was a full-on attack against a Republican nominee, something that hadn't been seen before, and it was, as I say, really the starting pistol. Kennedy, the Democrats who'd kind of had their way through the Warren Court and even the Burger Court, were now going to fight to protect what they felt was the conservative, even really neoconservative encroachment on what the gains they had made during the last few decades.
And it really indicated a major shift in terms of intense politicization of the Supreme Court, and would indeed have effects going all the way through the Kavanaugh nomination up to the present, which we'll talk about. But I wanted also to talk about something that Robert Bork said during that process. He was asked, why do you want to be on the Supreme Court? And he said, because it would be an intellectual feast, and that stirred up a real hornet's nest.
Everybody, if there was ever a moment, you know, and there often are, you've been paying attention to all these kind of things for a long time, too. And you're always waiting for that moment where it happens. And you can, it's not just the moment, of course, in reality, but the moment crystallizes all the earlier and follow-on moments. And when Robert Bork, who was not liked at all by the Democrats, and who they caricaturized him in a really, you know, a vivid way. He had that Van Dyke beard. He had that aspect and attitude where he was lecturing to the senators. In so many ways, he was already stumbling. But when Alan Simpson from Wyoming gave him that softball question, or as his final question, the real opportunity for the guy to hit it out of the park, what Bork says is it would be an intellectual feast, not, you know, I'm here to protect the rights of Americans and, you know, on and on and on, which you would expect somebody to have practiced saying at that moment. And the eruption in the news, reporters up and running down for the Associated Press to send out their bulletins, you know, intellectual feast. We pulled headlines from newspapers all across America, and that was the way that the crystallization of it. And one person we talked to, Joe Biden's chief of staff, said, we wondered when he said it, if it's an intellectual feast, who's the dinner? And that was basically the way that that I think a lot of certainly the Democrats and an awful lot of television viewers who had no real understanding or precedence to review anything about this felt about Robert Bork when he sailed off into the sunset.
Talking with Michael Kirk, a documentary filmmaker for PBS Frontline. His new documentary, Supreme Revenge, about the origins of today's conservative court, airs tonight at 10 o'clock on KQED television. And this really led directly, did it not, to the Federalist Society? And let's talk about that.
Well, they existed, you know, as at University of Chicago, Harvard, and Yale. They had about 15 students at each place, but they had advisors at Chicago. They had Antonin Scalia. At Yale, they had Bork on the faculty. And as they sort of stumbled along, and then all of a sudden, when Bork went down in flames, a grassroots movement really got started within that year. Money came flowing in from what are sometimes described as dark money sources, the Olin Foundation and many other conservative groups. It went from a group that was at those three campuses and maybe couple hundred members eventually to what now is 60,000 members and a budget at that early period of $70,000 $700,000 became $26 million this year. That organization, if there was one organization that was responsible for what's been the conservative remaking of the United States Supreme Court, as an organization, the Federalist Society, primary as an individual, Mitch McConnell.
And in fact, you mentioned dark money. You talked to Jane Mayer, who talked about the foundations that were established, money and ideas and access and network and in 10 years, 120 chapters. And I want to get ahead of the story here a bit, but you spoke to Steve Bannon as well, among many people that you spoke to. And he said this was probably responsible more than anything else for the election of Donald Trump, because he gave that list right from the Federalist Society. These are the judges that I would nominate.
That's right. It was an amazing thing, Michael, to watch the trajectory of that group. And it caused me, in the 40 or so interviews I did for this film, to ask especially a lot of Democrats who served in the Senate and were keenly interested in this issue, members of organizations pushing for progressives on the Supreme Court. And I ask every one of them, where were the Democrats when the Federalist Society was rising? Where was the corollary, the opposing group? And of course, some laughed and said, the opposing group were the law schools all over America, which were inherently progressive and liberal. But also, they said, this thing that sticks with me even today, which is Democrats have never really fought as hard or acknowledged the power and effect of the court, even in presidential elections, in the way that certainly Republicans have learned to do under the aegis of the Federalist Society and politicians like Mitch McConnell.
Well, we're talking about civil rights and abortion as main issues against the Bork nomination, and now as the Federalist Society rises in power, they bring into focus gay rights and also what they think of as criminal rights. I thought we'd hear another clip from your Frontline documentary. This is about how, after Bork, the Federalist Society became one of the most powerful forces in Washington.
The scale and scope was fantastic. They get into more and more law schools until they have a chapter in every law school in the country. They have a lawyer's chapter in all the major cities. They're vetting all the nominees for federal judgeships.
Their revenue had grown to more than $26 million. There were now over 60,000 members.
The numbers are enormous, the money is enormous, and every important conservative jurist is a member. All the conservative members of the Supreme Court and the rest of the courts on down through America.
Again, we're talking with Michael Kirk, documentary filmmaker for PBS Frontline. His new documentary, Supreme Revenge, about the origins of today's conservative court, airs tonight at 10 on KQED-TV. So then, Michael, we have an opening suddenly, 1991, a vacancy. Thurgood Marshall retires, and who comes along? Clarence Thomas, who was pretty much designated as the fill-in for Thurgood Marshall by the Federalist Society, and who, as I recall, President George H.W. Bush said was the most qualified man in the United States of America. And it looked pretty certain that because he was African-American and because he would be succeeding Thurgood Marshall, there was a likelihood that he would probably get through until, well, Anita Hill.
Exactly. If Bork had been challenged on his ideology and his politics, what happens with Thomas is he begins to be that another line gets crossed, which is character. It doesn't start out that way, and the Republicans.
This is also televised. We should add. I mean, again, all the action is
fully televised.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. In that same hearing room where, you know, the Watergate hearings had been held and the Bork hearings had been held. So here we go again. And a candidate in Thomas that feels he's got it made. He's not going to be Borked, a new word in the language as a result of the Bork hearings. He's going to answer, well, it's a hypothetical senator. I don't really want to go on with that. He's not going to make the mistakes Bork made. But then suddenly, something about his character emerges, and another line gets crossed in this process of head-on politics between the Republicans and the Democrats over a nominee.
And a 43-year-old gets nominated to the Supreme Court, despite, let's say, some opposition, but not enough from the Democrats. In fact, Joe Biden has now been getting a great deal of flack and fallout for his position as head of the Judiciary Committee at that time. I want to give out the number because I know many of you know this history, but a lot of younger listeners, as I said, don't. And I want to hear your response, particularly to the thesis that overrides this film, which is that, indeed, you go back to the Bork nomination. And I remember, in fact, doing some political commentary at the time and saying this really means the politicization of the Supreme Court, as it indeed did, one of the few times Sometimes I was prescient about things. And it's also something that we can tie into the present, and the film does that in a very calculated, seems to me, in a very dramatic way. You can join us, and let me invite you to do so with questions or comments. Mitch McConnell being sort of the wizard behind all of this, the title goes to Mitch McConnell's desire for supreme revenge and redemption after losing the Bork nomination. And it all follows a pretty linear fashion. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to weigh in, we'd like to hear from you. Please feel free to join us. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also join us right now by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. So in effect, we've got the Federalist Society behind also the Gorsuch and Kavanaugh nominations.
Well, and just before that, you have the Federalist Society behind the idea of verifying that Donald Trump was in fact a conservative, and what, as you mentioned earlier, what Steve Bannon says was the definitive moment when they provided him with that list of potential bona fide conservatives, that made him, he knew the power of what that was, and waved the list prominently, saying to Republican conservatives who weren't quite sure about who he really was, when he had that list, it's and he promised that he would pick people from the list for the Supreme Court. That was an election issue that conservatives could 100% get behind, and they did. And that's why Bannon says that was the fundamental reason for Trump's election and his willingness, therefore, to put Gorsuch and eventually Kavanaugh on the court.
And just to bring things up to date for a moment, there's an empty seat in the Congress today that should have been filled, or was supposed to have been filled, because of a subpoena by Don McGahn, the president's attorney. And Don McGahn was also very involved in the Federalist Society and very involved in this whole establishment of a list. Let me read some comments that are coming in. Richard writes, I heard from congressional staffers that Robert Bork was unpopular and arrogant. People forget that there were a number of Republican senators who voted against him. Point well taken. And Bill writes, doesn't Joe Biden take some responsibility for the present court? When he chaired the Senate Judiciary Committee, he supported the confirmation of Clarence Thomas. And again, I think that's a point that has certainly been made by those who were trying to get the Democratic, arrest the Democratic nomination out of Joe Biden, who's leading the field right now. And so it goes. I want to bring our callers in, though. And again, Michael Kirk is with us, and his film is Supreme Revenge, done for Frontline. Here's Amy. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have a question for Michael, and I wanted to know what's the legality behind McConnell getting away with obstructing Obama's nominations for Supreme Court? How does he get away with that legally?
The Merrick Garland nomination she's referring to here. Yeah, Michael Kirk.
It's an amazing moment. Antonin Scalia has died within hours. McConnell has said that as the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, they will not interview and they will not hold hearings on a candidate on a nominee from President Obama, because Obama's in the last term of his term of office. Well, Bork was a last minute or a last year nominee as well. It's an interesting there was no precedent. It was unprecedented what he did. I don't know that there are any legal prohibitions against him doing it, but most people would say that, you know, if you want to play fair, this is not a fair moment. I asked Nina Totenberg, the legendary observer of the court for NPR, how unprecedented it was. And she said there's no precedent for it, none whatsoever. But he did it, and he got away with it. And it's because of him that the Supreme Court and Kavanaugh are the way they are. And he knew he had to do this. This was the second half of his, or this was the first half of his revenge moment, was he had to stop Obama from putting someone on the court, and he did.
Yeah, suddenly we had no hearings. We had the blocking of really any possibility of him meeting with the Judiciary Committee the way it was done traditionally. And let me get another caller on here. It's Elvin. Elvin, you're on. Morning.
Yes, and I was curious how much Bork's participation in the Saturday Night Massacre affected his not getting the votes.
What do you think, Michael Cook?
That's a really, really good question, and it's one that I ask a lot of people. It's in the air so strongly. Remember, for anybody who doesn't remember, just very quickly, the President Nixon was trying to fire the special counsel Archibald Cox, or independent counsel, whatever he was, I don't remember. But anyway, and his own attorney general and the deputy attorney general, the equivalent of Sessions and Rosenstein, refused to do it. And Bork, as Solicitor General, stepped up and said, I will do it. And there's an awful lot of people who were in that vintage in Washington who say it just didn't sit right with the Democrats. But I think also that that may be true, but it was his politics, I'm convinced. It was where he stood on abortion, on privacy rights, on many other things that that they were determined to stop.
Michael, I wonder, could you not get to Mitch McConnell? There was certainly a lot of interviewing of his chief of staff, but did he refuse?
Mitch McConnell is very, as they say in Washington, careful about it. He chooses his interviews and his opportunities to his advantage, not to mine or yours or necessarily the public's. There is a big, long interview with Mitch McConnell in the New York Times Sunday magazine around the time we were making the film. And I tried to use it as an example of, come on, let's play fair. Let's go both ways. But he was, of course, not going to help us. It is amazing with these very powerful people in Washington, the extent to which they, especially if they don't own the outlet, if it's not Fox or it's not, you know, Breitbart or it's not someone else, they don't really feel the imperative to play. I've been doing this for a long time, and they don't feel the imperative to play the way politicians once upon a time did.
Got a listener here who thinks that maybe this started much earlier with FDR and his court packing scheme.
Well, there's always been these battles. There's, you know, this is not, it's not a pure game, but it's the idea of how public it all was. The court packing was the court packing, and yes, it happened. But this is something very different. This is, I think, and the people I've talked to in the film all believe it, and they are long standing. They're more than just me, a television journalist. They are people who've been doing this for a long time on both sides of the aisle, and they say this is the most destructive process they could imagine, that this place, the one place left in our democracy during these destructive political times, or at least disruptive political times, that there used to be one place that it, even during Roosevelt, before and beyond, even if you didn't like the court and didn't like what it was doing, there was this sense that it was not politically motivated in quite the same way, and not the direct way that it was when Kavanaugh announced in his pushback to Dr. Blasey Ford that Clinton and others were and liberal money was part of this process. He made it political in that moment, and now they say it truly is.
Michael Kirk, I congratulate you on the film and good luck with it. Michael Kirk's new film is called Supreme Revenge. It airs tonight at 10 on KQED9. I thank you again for joining us, and in the next half hour, we talk with two Supreme Court reporters about the current court and the cases they face. Stay with us. It's up ahead. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the conservative majority, the new conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. And joining us now is Greg Storp, the Supreme Court reporter with Bloomberg News. Greg, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good to be on, Michael.
Well, I guess the place to begin is what everybody is trying to anticipate, and that is where the Supreme Court, we talked about the whole history, how it continued to turn right, and now really is perhaps right, with Kennedy having been the swing vote and now replaced by Kavanaugh, certainly a conservative. And what can we, I mean, I don't suspect you have any tea leaves here any more than anybody else, but there's been 14 deferrals of abortion-related cases, and yet there are a number of them that are possibly coming up for review by the high court. What can we expect?
It's really hard to know what to expect, except that we can see pretty clear evidence that the court is trying to kick the can down the road a little bit on this issue. And that's really a theme for the court this whole term, trying to defer the most contentious issues until a later point. These are all cases that are not as nearly as big as the Alabama law that outlaws pretty much all abortions. They're smaller issues, but how the court acts on them could give us a real indication about how quickly Chief Justice John Roberts and new Justice Brett Kavanaugh in particular want to move on the abortion issue.
They could act on Alabama, but there's, I guess, anticipation that they're more likely to act on Indiana or Kentucky. Maybe you can sort of spell that out for us in terms of timing.
Yeah, so there are right now, in the next couple weeks, the court could act on either or both of two Indiana appeals. One of them has to do with a law that requires abortion clinics to either bury or cremate fetal remains. And that same law also says that a woman can't have abortion because of a fear of a risk of a genetic disorder. And then there's a second Indiana law in a separate appeal that says that there has to be an 18-hour waiting period between an ultrasound and the abortion procedure. Those cases, the first one has been the one that's been kicked over more than a dozen times. The court, often when it does defer things over and over like that, it's often a sign that they've decided not to hear the appeal and somebody is writing a dissent from that decision not to hear it. But occasionally, as happened a couple terms ago with a case involving gay wedding cakes, the court will keep kicking things over and then eventually say, okay, we will hear it. So at this point, we're just waiting to see what the court will do with those cases.
But the court, of course, can decide not to do anything if they want to, right?
They could. They could just simply say, we're not going to hear this appeal. That seems unlikely without at least some opinion to go along with it, just because they've been there's clearly some behind the scenes wrangling going on with that case. As I said, at this point, we're really just waiting to see. And that is just one of the two Indiana cases, I guess, are just two of several abortion-related petitions that are pending there. One other possibility that I should throw out is that with each of these, they could decide we're just going to hold it because there's another abortion case down the road that we are actually going to hear, and we'll hold this one and decide that one.
It's Greg Storr on the line with us, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News. Let me bring in Jacqueline Thompson, who also joins us for this segment. She's a court reporter for The Hill. And Jacqueline, welcome. Good to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'd like your thoughts about where this is all going, particularly since we had both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh actually deciding not to defund Planned Parenthood. And, you know, Chief Justice Roberts has wanted to some extent to show balance on the court. That's been kind of a major, shall we say, hobby horse of his at this point, it seems, or something that he's deeply concerned about. Where do you see the court turning, particularly on abortion? Or is the court even going to hear something on abortion?
Well, I think Chief Justice Roberts, like you mentioned, he's very concerned about the reputation of the court. He really wants to make sure that it can play its role in American politics and being sort of an institution that is fair and balanced. And with the addition of Brett Kavanaugh to the court, you know, the entire court has shifted a bit to the right, which lands Roberts a bit in the ideological center. So the issue there is, okay, is he going to be a vote on these abortion cases? Frankly, I think the Supreme Court is going to keep kicking the can down the road, like Greg mentioned earlier. I think they're just trying to stay away from these more decisive issues and make sure they're not going to issue something that could potentially end up on the ballot for 2020. You know, we have a presidential election coming up. Anything done by the Supreme Court is also reflective of the executive in general, since the president is the one appointing the justices.
Well, since you mentioned, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, since you mentioned 2020, I was just going to bring in the fact and get your response to it. It's a political fact, but President Trump has said that he does not agree with the Obama law when it comes to making no exceptions of rape or incest.
Yeah, and you know, this law was really drafted as an attempt to try to get the court to take up this question of Roe v. Wade, whether or not they're going to appeal it or reverse it, rather. So this law is not necessarily about making sure those rules are enforced within the state, but really at getting this entire precedent overturned. But the fact is that the court probably isn't going to take it up just because it is asking them to move very quickly. And this court seems a little more hesitant in making big decisions like that.
Jacqueline Thompson with us. She's court reporter for The Hill, and Greg Storr is also with us, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News, and you can be with us. In fact, we're going to talk about some cases that are in the docket, and we want to hear your thoughts, particularly in terms of where this right-wing now, as it's often characterized, or right-leaning court is going. You can join us at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your calls, 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website at kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. What do you make, Greg Storr, out of Justice Breyer coming out publicly and making statements, well, about precedents and other things that seem to at least be warning shots, I guess?
Yeah, it was very noteworthy. This came in a case that had nothing to do with abortion on its surface, but it had a lot to do with overturning precedents. It was a case involving a Nevada man who was trying to sue California officials for being overzealous and trying to collect some taxes in Nevada state court. And the Supreme Court, the conservatives in a 5-4 decision said that California officials are immune under the Constitution from that lawsuit. And to get there, the court had to overrule a 40-year-old precedent. And in that context, Stephen Breyer wrote a dissent where he said the court was way too quick to overturn a precedent, one that he said actually hadn't really caused any problems in the intervening years. And he ended it with, and along the way, he cited for support some precedents involving abortion, including the Planned Parenthood decision from 1990. Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and he finished the decision with this line that said that today's decision can only cause one to wonder which cases the court will overrule next. Certainly, it is fair to speculate that he at least had abortion in mind as he was penning those words. That's one of many areas where the court could overturn rulings, but certainly one of the most high profile.
Well, Jacqueline Thompson, if it seems to be the case now that we have a swing vote in Kavanaugh that was the swing vote of Kennedy on abortion, at least, the Louisiana case is really important to highlight here, is it not?
Yeah, I agree that it's also something to definitely keep in mind as we're moving forward. You know, Kavanaugh and Roberts are both votes that people aren't necessarily certain on about how they're going to rule on abortion just because we have seen them side with the liberal justices before. So whether or not they're going to do so in the future, we're not entirely sure. And, you know, it's also important to note that Kavanaugh is relatively new to the bench. He's the youngest justice. He's still, you know, testing out the waters, trying to figure out his role. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how he fits into that going forward, particularly on these more high-profile cases like abortion.
I think Kavanaugh may have been signaling where he's going with that ruling on Louisiana. I'm reading a comment from a listener now, though, who says, if these legislative attempts to upend Roe v. Wade succeed, it would confirm yet another conservative trope that precedence matters as complete nonsense. Well, I want to go to what's in the docket here, but let me go to a caller first. And again, we invite you to join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. If you have questions about the present Supreme Court and where things are headed, we're not only going to talk about abortion, but as I said, I want to talk about some other cases that are indeed in the docket. And Ruth Ann joins us first here. Ruth Ann, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the guests and you, Michael Krasny, what your thoughts are on the theory that although Justice Kennedy did present some of the swing votes on key cases, he was at heart a diehard conservative. And largely it's been posited that he timed his resignation so that when he resigned, President Trump would replace him. And he knew or was calculating that that would be with a conservative replacement. And so it was timed so that it would tilt the court more conservatively in his absence.
Well, that was a question we took up on forum, and there was also the fact that Kennedy had a son-in-law who worked in the Trump administration. I'm just wondering, Greg Starr, can you put some light on this for us? You think, the timing was strange because usually they don't resign when he resigned. I mean, they resigned a different time of the year.
Yeah, well, he resigned at the end of the term, which is when justices often do, either at the very end of the term or perhaps leading up to the end of the term. In one sense, it's not surprising that he retired with a Republican president because he was appointed by a Republican president, and his longstanding ties are more Republican than Democratic. In terms of him being a conservative, I think it's fair to say he was more conservative than liberal, but there were some issues where he was very much on the liberal side, and gay rights is certainly the best example of that. He wrote the three biggest gay rights rulings the Supreme Court has ever issued, including the Obergefell decision that legalized gay marriage. So it did kind of depend on what issue we're talking about with Kennedy. At the end of the day, though, he felt apparently comfortable enough to retire with Donald Trump in office, and to appoint somebody who in all likelihood will be even more conservative than Kennedy.
And again, Greg Starr is Supreme Court reporter with Bloomberg News, and Jacqueline Thompson is court reporter for The Hill. So let's talk with you, Jacqueline, about what's coming up on the court. I mean, there's a big census citizenship case, there's a gerrymandering case, and we could talk about them each individually, but what I'd really like to hear from you is what's particularly imminent now, and what do you think is going to happen with this court?
Yeah, they are on a bit of a time crunch with that census citizenship question case, like you mentioned. The Census Bureau has said that they need to start printing materials in June, and the court normally likes to sit on those big blockbuster decisions until about the last week of the month. So at this point, it seems like they're going to have to accelerate that timetable a little bit in order to make way for that deadline, which a lot of court watchers think they're going to do. So it's possible that over the next few weeks, we'll be seeing a decision on that, which really I do think is the most high-profile case of the term so far. But we also can't forget those partisan gerrymandering cases, like you mentioned. We're having those for Maryland and North Carolina will both be coming out. And it's an opportunity for the Supreme Court to kind of create a test in terms of what kind of district map constitutes a partisan gerrymander. And they're even facing some outside pressure because you've seen judges in other states strike down district maps that were considered to be partisan gerrymanders by them, and we're having them appealed up to the Supreme Court. So we're going to also see if they'll take up those cases as well, or if the decision that they issue in either of these two cases involving the other states could impact those other rulings.
They're going to pick up this case on race and jury selection for death penalty cases?
Yeah, that'll be coming up as soon, the Flowers case. It seems like the justices during arguments were on the side of the inmate and thinking that there was, a racial bias in the jury selection pool, so it's very possible that he could be ending up getting a new trial, and that's a decision that will also be coming out in the coming weeks.
And Greg Starr, can I get you to talk about Apple and the class action lawsuit and where that's headed?
Yeah, this was an interesting decision, in part because of the breakdown. Justice Kavanaugh joined the liberals on the court in the majority, saying that Apple could be sued. The core question here is whether people who buy apps on the Apple App Store could sue Apple, saying we were charged too much and deserve damages because Apple charged very high commissions to the developers of the apps. And there's a longstanding Supreme Court doctrine that says that you, under federal antitrust law, you cannot sue if you are the indirect purchaser of something. So if you're downstream and bought it from a middleman, bought some product for a middleman, you can't sue the manufacturer for overcharging the middleman. And in this case, Justice Kavanaugh joined the liberals on the court to say, as I understand what's going on here in the app market, the consumers are actually buying these apps directly from Apple. There is not a middleman involved, and therefore this suit can go ahead and they can potentially get hundreds of millions of dollars or even billions of dollars in damages, and Apple may feel more pressure to reduce those commissions.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one to follow. Let me get another caller on, though. John, join us. You're on the air.
Oh, our globe was a fascinating thing, yeah.
I'm sorry? John, are you there? No? Okay. Here's a listener who sends a question in here. This is Melinda, who wants to know about the American Legislative and Exchange Council. I don't know how up-to-date either of you are on this, but she wants to know, where does ALEC, the right-wing legislative plotting group, fit in with the Federalist Society? Can you help us here, Jacqueline Thompson?
I'm afraid I'm not very familiar with their work, but we do see the Federalist Society as a really powerful tool of conservatives in Washington. So they're not going to let up any of their impact on the judicial system as long as President Trump and the Republicans are in power in D.C.
Yeah, we just did a segment with the frontline filmmaker Michael Kirk, which takes us really to the Federalist Society and the kind of power they have now. Greg Stewart, let me follow that up with a question to you just about that power, because it's not only the federal judiciary, it's a judiciary throughout the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but President Trump has been very successful. Perhaps his most his biggest success has come from putting judges on not just the Supreme Court, but federal appeals courts, federal district courts. And almost without exception, these are judges who are supported by people affiliated with the Federalist Society. They are likely to be very conservative judges, and that impact is going to be with us for many decades. I may just point out that it just came out, but there's a very interesting new article in the Washington Post about Leonard Leo, who's a top Federalist Society official who's been advising President Trump on judicial nominations, and a brand new investigative piece talking about all his influence and the money behind that movement.
Well, Steve Bannon in the film that Michael Kirk made said the president doesn't really care that much about policy and doesn't know a whole lot about it, but he goes to the Federalist list and did with Gorsuch and did certainly with Kavanaugh, in large part because that's where the backing is and that's where the base is. I wonder, Greg, you don't know about ALEC? Can't answer the listener's question?
I'm afraid I can't shed a whole lot of light there.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Well, maybe somebody can and could write us and let us know. But here's a fascinating question from a listener who says, how do your guests anticipate the court ruling on whether recipients of House Judiciary Committee subpoenas must comply with them? Jacqueline Thompson, you want to go out on a limb here?
Oh, well, I don't know if it's even going to make it up to the Supreme Court. I wouldn't be surprised if the Trump administration tried to push it up there. You know, we saw the ruling yesterday from the district court judge in D.C. saying that the subpoena should be upheld. The lawyers responded immediately this morning by appealing it to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That Court of Appeals is actually ironically headed by Merrick Garland, but who knows if he'll be the judge hearing the case, as it's often taken up by a full panel. But, you know, if the Court of Appeals decides to uphold the subpoenas, well, we could see the president taking this all the way to the Supreme Court. And in that position, I think the court might be forced to take up the case just because it is such an important matter and it's such a timely one as well. And it really gets down to these core separation of powers issues. But at the same time, it really doesn't seem like the president's legal argument is holding up in court. What was really interesting in the ruling yesterday is the judge effectively shut them down on almost all areas and effectively said, you have no standing and none of this makes any sense to me. So will the court take it up? It's possible. I don't know how they would rule, though.
What about, since Greg Stewart, Jacqueline mentions court separation, core separation of powers, I'm struck by a fascinating case out of Maryland, which I'm sure you're familiar with, about separation of church and state. You got this 40-foot-tall memorial cross for World War I veterans. Where do we stand on that?
Yeah, we're waiting for the court to rule on that. That's up there with the census case and the gerrymandering case that Jacqueline talked about in terms of the biggest cases or the most anticipated cases of the year. The court heard arguments and seemed like there was a consensus that they wanted to let the cross stay, maybe with a narrow decision that would say because This was a possibility thrown out by one of the liberal justices, Justice Kagan, that maybe because the cross has some special significance with regard to World War I, that is the image that a lot of people have with the cemeteries in Europe with rows of crosses lined up, that because of that special history, that maybe this particular cross might be constitutional, but that doesn't mean that the government can willy-nilly put up crosses everywhere when they're in a different context.
And if you've just joined us, we are talking about Supreme Court cases that are in the docket. We were talking earlier with Michael Kirk about the conservative majority in the Supreme Court and how it evolved, particularly going back to the Bork decision to not put or not seat Robert Bork onto the U.S. Supreme Court. Jacqueline Thompson with us, court reporter for The Hill, and Greg Storr, who is Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, and I urge you to support this radio station. In fact, you can support this radio station in a number of ways. For more information about how to do that, you simply go to kqed.org. And we're going to go back to some callers here in just a moment, but let me go first to the pledge people who want to talk to you. And I'm going to, in fact, identify myself. I'm Michael Krasny, and let's go back in a moment or two. Okay, we're going to come back here now to Mike and Hayward. Mike, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I think what is being lost is some of the terrible decisions that they're making in favor of corporations against individual consumers and employees. Like 2 weeks ago, there was a decision that said that there can't be any class actions in arbitration. And the court, like 7 years ago, forced everybody into arbitration who merely had a stuffer in their bill or signed a employment agreement. And now, if you don't have class actions, nobody really has rights anymore against corporations because there's no way to bring it in an economic way, which the California Supreme Court said 15 years ago, and that was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. So, I mean, now if you have an issue against Comcast or against a phone company, you have no resort anymore as of 2 weeks ago. There's no more class actions in arbitration. So, I mean, nobody's, you know, abortion's important, but your rights have just gone out the window against corporations as of 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, Mike, thank you for bringing that up. And Greg Storr, let me go to you again on this.
Yeah, the caller's right that this is a really important, actually, series of opinions the court has written over several years. And basically what the court has said is there's a 1925 law called the Federal Arbitration Act, which says we need to enforce arbitration like any other contract. And the court has taken that to mean that if your employer or your cell phone provider has a contract with you, and in there it says you have to arbitrate any disputes, and you can't bring them as a class. You have to arbitrate them individually. The courts will enforce that agreement. This latest opinion was sort of talking about what happens when the arbitration agreement doesn't specifically talk about class actions. And the Supreme Court said in this ruling, another 5-4 ruling with the conservatives in the majority, the Supreme Court said, well, unless it explicitly says that class arbitration is okay, we're not going to allow class arbitration. Certainly a huge impact, all these decisions, and the caller is right that it does make it much, much harder for individuals to press claims that really can only go forward as a group.
Yeah, I'm really glad Mike brought this up. Jacqueline Thompson, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I think as long as we have a conservative majority on the court, we're going to see a lot more pro-business rulings. Greg is totally correct in saying that a lot of these decisions are going to make it harder for these kinds of arbitration to take place. You know, Justice Ginsburg was really adamant in her dissent a couple weeks ago in that decision in saying that the court rather needs to be giving more power back to workers and employers, and that without these forms of legal pathways, they're just not going to be able to have any sort of way to gain back wages or have any sort of influence in these fights against their employers. So, you know, but as long as we're seeing a conservative court, I think we're going to see a lot more pro-business decisions coming out of it.
Well, that prompts me to ask you, and I'll begin with you, Jacqueline, then we'll go back to Greg, where this is all leading us with a court that's tilting more to the right. What else do you foresee?
Well, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more action on the state level that could be forcing this court to take it up. Like, I could see a lot of more business groups filing lawsuits that aimed at getting it up to the Supreme Court and aimed at getting rulings that are on their behalf. And we're seeing that sort of play out with abortion, with these laws coming across all different states. And a number of other topics could be kind of using the same exact strategy, saying, okay, if we can get this up through the court system, what can we do to get an advantage with a conservative majority right now?
And maybe with little time left, Greg Storr, that may be ominous, particularly for those who want more environmental regulation?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an area where we have already seen a conservative-liberal divide. You may well see the court's conservatives limiting what the EPA can do, or, you know, on the flip side, giving the Trump administration EPA or other Republican EPAs more power to limit environmental regulations. If I just quickly note one other case the court's going to hear next term that's going to be a really big deal is whether the federal job discrimination laws cover sexual orientation and gender identity. That's likely to be a case where we're going to see a liberal-conservative split as well.
Yeah, that is indeed a big case. And thank you both so much for helping us understand what's going on with this court and what is up ahead. Greg Storr, again, a Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you, Greg. Good to have you.
Sure. Great to be on.
And thank you, Jacqueline Thompson, court reporter for The Hill.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you on as well. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And when we come back, we're going to talk about dentistry. There's an article in the Atlantic magazine which stirred up a whole controversy about how scientific is dentistry and are people being overcharged and are they not necessarily getting, well, the best care in terms of their mouths. Stay ahead. It's Up Ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.